White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Tonight, we're bringing you chapter 67 of a total 80 chapters that comprise the complete book. It is November 7th, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm the other one.
This chapter is just short of 4,500 words heading, whereas last week's was 4,198 words. Which we didn't quite finish. So it behooves us to move right along tonight. And if we have time left at the end, we can discuss whatever seems important to us. Otherwise, I'll just say now that I think that this chapter is teaching us how the Jews managed to get their Shabbos goys and what kind of people these Shabbos goys are to begin with. They always have to have some fatal weakness in their personality, which can be exploited. And that's not all that rare in white people, is it?
Well, we have some specific weaknesses that have been pointed out, like altruism that isn't as discriminating as it should be, a tendency to want to have faith in the possibilities for the individual to redeem himself rather than thinking in groups.
Well, I don't think that's what this is speaking about, because this is, this Benedict Arnold. This is about Benedict Arnold, who is, was not being altruistic at all. You know, that wasn't his
point. No, he wasn't.
Point. So this is a different guy. I'm talking about, like, human weaknesses.
Yeah, well, that's his personal thing there.
But see, a lot of that's what they work on. They find people people who don't have these things, they don't get anywhere with them. So they seek out these kind of people with these weaknesses.
Apparently he had an excess of the urge to self-enrichment and self-aggrandizement. He was a little bit too much of an individualist.
Yeah, all right. So, well, let's just go ahead and get going with it.
All righty. It's chapter 67, The Jewish Associates of Benedict Arnold. As the Jewish propagandists in the United States cannot be trusted to give the people all the facts, even though these propagandists have the facts in their possession, it devolves upon some impartial agency to do so. The Jewish propagandists are accorded the utmost freedom of the newspapers of the United States by reason of Jewish advertising, being more than 75% of all the advertising done in this country. And thus a wide web of false impressions is constantly being woven around the Jewish question. The most recent is the widespread publication of a new exposure of the origin of the protocols. This makes the sixth final and complete exposure that the Jews have put forth for public consumption. The Jews have still time to repent and tell the truth. Suppose they make the seventh the whole truth, with a complete repudiation of the protocols. It is the Dearborn Independent's purpose to open up from time to time new angles of the Jewish question, so that the candid reader who would be informed of the extensive character of Jewish influence may obtain a general view of it. The part taken by Jews in the wars of the United States has been a subject of considerable boasting by Jewish publicists. It is a most interesting subject. It deserves the fullest possible treatment. It is not the Dearborn Independent's present purpose to challenge the Jewish boast. It is, however, our purpose to fill in the omitted parts of the story, and supply the missing links in several of the most interesting episodes in American history. This will be done on the basis of unquestioned historical authority, mostly of a Jewish character, and solely in the interests of a complete understanding of a matter which Jewish leaders have brought to the front. The first subject which will be treated in this series is the part of Jews in the treason of Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold, the most conspicuous traitor in American history, has been the subject of considerable comment of late. Among the commentators have been American Jews who have failed to make known to the American public the information which may be found in Jewish archives concerning Benedict Arnold and his associates. To begin with, the propensity of the Jews to engage in the business of supplying the needs of armies and to avail themselves, as far as possible, of war contracts is of long standing and notice. An authority on this matter, Werner Zombart, says in his Jews and Modern Capitalism, pages 50 through 53, and I'm just going to read this straight, the Jews throughout the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries were most influential as army purveyors and as the moneyed men to whom the princes looked for financial backing. We cannot attempt to mention every possible example. We can only point the way. It will be for subsequent research to follow. Although there are numerous cases on record of Jews acting in the capacity of army contractors in Spain previous to 1492, I shall not refer to this period because it lies outside the scope of our present considerations. We shall confine ourselves to the centuries that followed, and begin with England. In the 17th and 18th centuries, the Jews had already achieved renown as army purveyors. Under the Commonwealth, the most famous army contractor was Antonio Fernandez Carvajal, the great Jew, who came to London sometime between 1630 and 1635, and was very soon accounted among the most prominent traders in the land. In 1649, he was one of the five London merchants entrusted by the Council of State with the army contract for corn, which just means grain in British usage. It is said that he annually imported into England silver to the value of £100,000. In the period that ensued, especially in the wars of William III, Sir Solomon Medina, the Jew Medina, was the great contractor, and for his services he was knighted, being the first professing Jew to receive that honor.
Now that's really interesting. I have to break in and just say that. I found that very interesting. Here's the first one that was knighted. In when? 1600s.
It was the same in the Wars of the Spanish Succession. Here, too, Jews were the principal army contractors. In 1716, the Jews of Strasbourg recall the services they rendered the armies of Louis XIV, by furnishing information and supplying provisions. Indeed, Louis XIV's army contractor-in-chief was a Jew, Jacob Worms by name. And in the 18th century, Jews gradually took a more and more prominent part in this work.
Now, you know that Jacob Worms was, he came from the city of Worms, right?
Yeah. Right, probably.
That, you know, this is around the time when Napoleon said they had to take on surnames, and or if they took it later, whatever, but then he became, you know, he took the name of that, of where he was living. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Famous, okay. Famous German city, very old.
Yeah. In 1727, the Jews of Metz, brought into the city in the space of 6 weeks, 2,000 horses for food, and more than 5,000 for remounts. Field Marshal Maurice of Saxony, the victor of Fontenoy, expressed the opinion that his armies were never better served with supplies than when the Jews were the contractors. One of the best known of the army contractors in the time of the last two Louises was Serf Baer, in whose patent of naturalization it is recorded that, in the wars which raged in Alsace in 1770 and 1771, he found the opportunity of proving his zeal in our service and in that of the state. Similarly, the House of Gradus of Bordeaux was an establishment of international repute in the 18th century. Abraham Gradus set up large storehouses in Quebec to supply the needs of the French troops there. Under the revolutionary government, under the Directory, in the Napoleonic Wars, it was always the Jews who acted as purveyors. In this connection, a public notice displayed in the streets of Paris is significant. There was a famine in the city, and the Jews were called upon to show their gratitude for the rights bestowed upon them by the revolution by bringing in corn. They alone, says the author of the notice, can successfully accomplish this enterprise thanks to their business relations, of which their fellow citizens ought to have full benefit. A parallel story comes from Dresden. In 1720, the court Jew, Jonas Meyer, saved the town from starvation by supplying it with large quantities of corn. The chronicler mentions 40,000 bushels. All over Germany, the Jews from an early date were found in the ranks of army contractors. Wait a
this
minute.
This is just, still, yeah.
Still somber. I was quoting somebody. Yeah. All over Germany, the Jews from an early date were found in the ranks of the army contractors. Let us enumerate a few of them. There was Isaac Meyer in the 16th century, who, when admitted by Cardinal Albrecht as a resident of Halberstadt in 1537, was enjoined by him, in view of the dangerous times, to supply our monastery with good weapons and armor. There was Joselmann von Rosheim, who in 1548 received an imperial letter of protection because he had supplied both money and provisions for the army. Obviously just out of benevolence. In 1546, there is a record of Bohemian Jews who provided greatcoats and blankets for the army. In the next century, another Bohemian Jew, Lazarus by name, received an official declaration that he obtained either in person or at his own expense valuable information for the imperial troops, and that he made it his business to see that the army had a good supply of ammunition and clothing. The great elector also had recourse to Jews for his military needs. Lyman Gompertz and Solomon Elias were his contractors for cannon, powder, and so forth. There were numerous others. Samuel Julius, remount contractor under the elector Frederick Augustus of Saxony, the Model family, court purveyors and army contractors in the duchy of, what does that say? Ansbach, in the 7th, 17th and 18th centuries are well known in history. In short, as one writer of the time pithily expresses it, all the contractors are Jews, and all the Jews are contractors. Austria does not differ in this respect from Germany, France, and England. The wealthy Jews, who in the reign of the Emperor Leopold received permission to resettle in Vienna in 1670, the Oppenheimers, Wertheimers, Meyer Herschel, and the rest, were all army contractors. And we find the same thing in all the countries under the Austrian crown. Lastly, we must mention the Jewish army contractors who provisioned the American troops in the Revolutionary and Civil Wars. End of Zombart's quote. Zombart's record ceases there. He does not go on to mention the Jewish contractors who provisioned the American troops in the Revolutionary and Civil Wars. He doesn't name them. That task shall be the Dearborn Independence from time to time in the future. It is in the study of Jewish money-making out of war that the clues are found to most of the great abuses of which Jews have been guilty. In the present instance, it was in the matter of profiteering in war goods that the Jewish connections of Benedict Arnold were discovered. Wars are the Jews' harvests, is an ancient saying. Their predilection for the quartermaster's department has been observed anciently and modernly, their interest being mostly in profits and not in national issues, their traditional loyalty being to the Jewish nation, rather than to any other nation. It is only natural that they should be found to be the merchants of goods and information in times of war, that is, the war profiteers and the spies. As the unbroken program is traced through the Revolutionary War, through the American Civil War, and through the Great War of recent occurrence, First World War, the only change observable is the increasing power and profit of the Jews. Of course, famous Jewish spy would be Dreyfus in France, and in the USA there was the Rosenbergs. Mm-hmm. And most of the people that Senator Joseph McCarthy found himself concerned about just happened to be Jews.
And then that current one that is still in prison, doesn't he have a life imprisonment term? Pollard, yeah. That he supposedly is the worst spy of all time. He's did the most damage of anybody ever.
Wow.
I mean, that's what they say.
Although the number of Jews resident in the American colonies was very small, there were enough to make a mark on the Revolutionary War. And while there was no wholesome legislation against Jews, as there
wholesale legislation.
Oh, there was no wholesale. It would be wholesome, too.
Yeah.
While there was no wholesale legislation against Jews, as there was in the Civil War, there were actions against individuals for the same causes, which in 1861 through 65 obtained more extensively. I'm not aware of actual legislation from the war between the states against Jews. I know that General Grant issued an order prohibiting Jews from going into newly occupied areas because they went in there to take advantage of the situation.
Well, I think he's saying there's just actions against individuals.
Yeah, well, there wasn't legislation that I know.
No. Well, he says there's no wholesale legislation. I guess that means there's no legislation in general, you know.
The journals of the Continental Congress contain numerous entries of payments made to Jews, as well as the records of various dealings with them on other scores. For drums, for blankets, for rifles, for provisions, for clothing. These are the usual entries. Most of the Jewish commissars were Indian traders. The extent to which the Jews dealt with the American Indians has not as yet been made a subject of research that it deserves. The Gratz family of Pennsylvania carried on a very extensive Indian trade and amassed a vast fortune out of it. A most curious lot of information concerning the dealings of the colonies with the Jews is obtainable by a search through the old records. The Jews of colonial New York were both loyalists and rebels as the tide turned. They profited under loyalism by the contracts which they secured, and by buying in the confiscated property of those who were loyal to the American cause. It is interesting to note that some of the purchasers of the extensive Delancey properties were Jews. Delancey was a patriot whom New York City afterward honored by giving his name to an important thoroughfare. That same New York has recently, by official action, separated the name of Delancey from that thoroughfare and substituted the name of Jacob H. Schiff, a Jew native of Frankfurt on the Main.
Gee, that's shocking. I mean, I've never heard of that. I didn't even really notice it much when I was reading this.
Yeah, well, it might be Martin Luther King Boulevard now.
Gosh, but to take this great, you know, to change, take this Irish name off and put on a Jewish name, good grief. Oh, that's New York.
Take off a patriot, revolutionary patriot's name and put on the name of a banker.
Oh.
It shows what the ethnicity runs New York, doesn't it?
Yes.
We enter immediately into the limits of the Benedict Arnold narrative by making mention of the Franks family of Philadelphia, of which family several members will claim our attention. The Franks were Jews from England who settled in America, retaining their English connections. They were in the business of public contracts, principally army contracts. They were holders of the British Army contracts for the French and Indian Wars and for the succeeding Revolutionary War. To get the picture, conceive it thus, as it is taken from Jewish sources. Moses Franks lived in England, doing business with the British government direct. He had the contract for supplying all the British forces in America before military trouble between the colonies and the home government was thought of. He was the principal purveyor of the British Army in Quebec, Montreal, Massachusetts, New York, and in the country of the Illinois Indians. It was all British territory then. Jacob Franks lived in New York. He was American representative of Moses Franks of England. He was the American agent of the Franks Army Purveyors Syndicate. For that is what it was. In Philadelphia was David Franks, son of Jacob of New York. David was the Franks agent for the state or colony of Pennsylvania. He was at the seat of the colonial government, the center of American politics, because Philadelphia was the capital at that time. He was hand in glove with many of the fathers of the American government. He was an immensely rich man, although but an agent, and carried a high hand at Philadelphia. At Montreal was another Franks, David Salisbury Franks, also in the business of army contractor. He was a gay young man, described as a blooded buck, who knew all the arts of turning an honest penny out of the needs of armies and the distress of nations. This young man was a grandson or grandnephew of the Moses Franks of England, as he was a nephew of the David Franks of Philadelphia.
Well, Hattie, for our younger listeners, maybe we should mention that this, of course, was written in 1921, when the term gay for homosexuals wasn't even dreamed of.
Yeah, I know that was. I know that was buzzing around in your head there. But you'll get around to thinking more about that, I'm sure, as we continue. Here and there,
I think that people might take it that way. There are some people who would take it that way.
Here and there were other Franks, all intent on business with the non-Jewish government, but the four here mentioned carry along the main parts of the tale. A moment's digression will give us at once a view of the looseness of the liberalism of some of the fathers of the country, and a view of the equanimity with which David Franks of Philadelphia could pass from one role to another, a facility which cost him dearly when war came on. John Trumbull, an artist of considerable note at the time, portrait painter, whose paintings still adorn the national capital, was invited to dine at Thomas Jefferson's home, among the guests being Senator Giles from Virginia. Trumbull tells the story. "I was secretly seated when Giles began to rally me on the puritanical ancestry and character of New England. I saw there was no person from New England present, and therefore, although conscious that I was in no degree qualified to manage a religious discussion, I felt myself bound to defend my country on this delicate point as well as I could. Whether it had been prearranged that a debate on the Christian religion, in which it should be powerfully ridiculed on the one side and weakly defended on the other, was to be brought forward as promising amusement to a rather free-thinking dinner party, I will not presume to say. But it had that appearance, and Mr. Giles pushed his raillery to my no small annoyance, if not to my discomfiture, until dinner was announced. That, I hope, would relieve me by giving a new turn to the conversation. But the company was hardly seated at table when he renewed the assault with increased asperity, and proceeded so far at last as to ridicule the character, conduct, and doctrines of the divine founder of our religion. Mr. Jefferson, in the meantime, smiling and nodding approval on Mr. Giles, while the rest of the company silently left me and my defense to our fate, until at length my friend David Franks took up the argument on my side. Thinking this a fair opportunity for avoiding further conversation on the subject, I turned to Mr. Jefferson and said, 'Sir, this is a strange situation in which I find myself, in a country professing Christianity, and at a table with Christians, I supposed...
As I supposed,
I find my religion and myself attacked with severe and almost irrepressible wit and raillery, and not a person to aid in my defense but my friend Mr. Franks, who is himself a Jew.' This episode throws a curious light on the character of Thomas Jefferson's philosophical unbelief, the unlovely fashion of that day. It also illustrates a certain facility in David Franks. Relations between the colonies and the mother country became strained. Political feelings ran high. The lines of division between American and British began to appear for the first time. At first, there was a degree of agreement among all the population, except the government officials, that a protest against governmental abuses was justified, and that strong representations should be made in behalf of the colonists. Even loyalists and imperialists agreed with that. It was a question of domestic politics, but when presently the idea of protest began to develop into the idea of rebellion and independence, a cleavage came. It was one thing to correct the empire, quite another thing to desert it. Here is where the people of the colonies split. Mr. Jacob Franks, in Royalist and Loyalist New York, was, of course, Royalist and Loyalist. As army contractor for the British government, he had no choice. Mr. David Franks, down in Philadelphia, was a little nearer the heart of the new American sentiment, and could not be so royal and loyal as was his kinsman North. In fact, David Franks tried to do what is modernly called the straddle, attempting to side with the empire and with the colonies, too. It was natural. His business was in Philadelphia. He may also have wished to remain as long as possible in the position of a spy and send information of the state of public feeling to the royalists. Moreover, he was received in good society, and his reputation for wealth and shrewdness won him attentions he could not otherwise have commanded. It's one of the perils of a society where wealth is equated with respectability. So, in 1765, we find him joining the merchants of Philadelphia in the pact not to import articles from England, while the hated Stamp Act was in force. In 1775, he favors the continuance of the colonial currency. He was enjoying his accustomed life in the city, and his acquaintance with the Shippen family, into which dashing young Benedict Arnold married.
Now, we're still talking about David Franks, right? Mr. David Franks.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, just to keep this straight for people, because...
There is a strange intermingling of all the tragic figures of the play. Benedict Arnold marries the girl for whom Major André wrote a parlor play. Major André, during his period of captivity as an American prisoner of war, and before his exchange, was often at the home of David Franks. And David Salisbury Franks, at his post as agent of the Franks Syndicate at Montreal, is placed by a strange turn of the wheel of destiny in the military family of Benedict Arnold for a considerable period preceding and including the Great Treason. Two David Franks here, the David Salisbury Franks in Montreal, who was very young, and the David Franks in Philadelphia.
Right.
So for the moment, let us leave the Jewish family of Franks, all of them still stationed as we first described them. Moses in England, Jacob at New York, David at Philadelphia, David S. at Montreal, and let us scrutinize the young American officer, Benedict Arnold. These facts would most of them be lost had they not been preserved in the Jewish archives by the American Jewish Historical Society. You will read any history of Benedict Arnold without perceiving the Jews around him. The authors of the accepted histories were blind. The principal defect in Benedict Arnold's character was his love of money. All of the trouble which led up to the situation in which he found himself with reference to the American government and army was due to the suspicion which hung like a cloud over many of his business transactions. There have been attempts to paint Arnold as a dashing martyr, as one who was discouraged by the unmerited slights of the Continental Congress, as a victim of the jealousy of lesser men, as one from whom confidence was unjustly withheld. Nothing could be further from the fact. He was a man to whom men were intrinsically drawn to be generous. But so general was the knowledge of his looseness in money matters that, while admiring him, his brother officers acted upon the protective instinct and held aloof from him. He was tainted by a low form of dishonesty before he was tainted with treason. and the chief explanation of his treason was in the hard bargain he drove as to the amount of money he was to receive for his guilty act. Arnold's own record makes this clear. Let us then take up his career at a certain point and see how the Franks strand and the money strand weave themselves together, weave themselves through it like colored threads. Extraordinary efforts have been made in recent years to extenuate Arnold's treason by the recital of his daring services. These services need not be minimized. Indeed, it was his great achievement of the winter march to Montreal and Quebec in 1775-76 that seems to begin the chapter of his troubles. To rehearse this feat of courage and endurance would be to tell a tale that has thrilled the American schoolboy. It was at Montreal that Benedict Arnold came into contact with the young Jew, David Solesbury Franks, the Canadian agent of the Franks Army Purveying Syndicate. And the next thing known about young Franks is that he returns to the American colonies in the train of Benedict Arnold as an officer of the American Army.
Oh, that was really funny. That is really funny.
How this change was effected is not explained in any of the records. There is a moment of darkness, as it were, in which the quick change was made, which transformed the young Montreal Jew from an army contractor for the British into an officer of Benedict Arnold's staff. But as it is impossible for every fact to be suppressed, there are here and there indications of what might have been, what indeed most probably was, the basis of the attraction and relation between the two. It was very probably, almost certainly, the opportunities for graft, which could be capitalized by a combination of General Arnold's authority and young Frank's ability in the handling of goods. From the day they met in Montreal until the hour when General Arnold fled, a traitor, from the fort on the Hudson, young David Solesbury Franks was his companion. The gay young man. Yeah. In one of the numerous court-martials which tried General Arnold for questionable dealings in matters pertaining to army supplies, Franks, who was aide-de-camp to Arnold, and by rank of major, testified thus: I had, by being in the army, injured my private affairs very considerably, and meant to leave it if a proper opportunity of entering into business should happen. I had several conversations on the subject with General Arnold, who promised me all the assistance in his power. He was to participate in the profits of the business I was to enter in. This testimony was given by Major Franks in 1779. The two men had met in the winter of 1775-76, but as the records will show, Major Franks was always General Arnold's reliance on getting out of scrapes caused by questionable business methods in which Arnold's military authority was used quite freely. Major Franks admits that he was to enter business and General Arnold was to share the profits. On what basis this arrangement could exist is another point not known. Arnold had no capital. He had no credit. He was a spendthrift, a borrower, notorious for his constant need of money. The only credible inducement for Franks to accept a partnership with him was on the understanding that Arnold should use his military authority to throw business to Franks. Or to state it more bluntly, the profits which Benedict Arnold was to receive were payments for his misuse of authority for his own gain. That's really a typical red flag for somebody that might end up being a traitor, somebody that it has money problems.
Oh, yeah, and we can think of Winston Churchill,
yeah,
who was supported by the Jews, and we can think of Woodrow Wilson, who wasn't really a money problem, but he needed
Well,
money.
He did have a money problem insofar as that woman that he had.
Yeah, right.
Child
money. And how many others, if we could just start
well,
thinking
about it? Not just traitors to the Jews, but that Aldrich Ames that was living high on the hog, you know, while working for the CIA. That guy was a real spendthrift with expensive tastes, and he was able to satisfy that because he was working for the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and then even when they were doing the programs on the baseball, the Jews in the baseball industry, and how they turned it into an industry. And then these baseball players, they got them into betting on games and so on, and then they got, you know, kind of hooked on that. And then you start living high on the hog, then you spend a lot of money, then you need more money, so you have to keep it up. I mean, that's really how they get most people. It's not the only thing, but they get most people with money, probably, don't you think? Yeah.
Yeah, it also shows the fundamental character flaw of poor self-control.
Yes, right.
It was at Montreal that Benedict Arnold's name first became attainted with rumors of shady dealings in private and public property. General George Washington had laid down the most explicit instructions on these matters, with a view to having the Canadians treated as fellow Americans, and not as enemies. General Washington had cashiered officers and whipped soldiers who had previously disobeyed the order against looting and theft. General Arnold had seized large quantities of goods at Montreal and had hurried them away without making proper account of them. This he admits in his letter to General Schuyler. Our hurry and confusion was so great, when the goods were received, it was impossible to take a particular account of them. This means only that Arnold seized the goods without giving the Canadian citizens proper receipts for them, so that he had in his hands a large amount of wealth for which he was under no compulsion to account to anybody. This mass of goods he sent to a Colonel Hazen at Chambly, and Colonel Hazen, evidently aware of the conditions under which the goods were taken, refused to receive them. This disobedience of Colonel Hazen to his superior officer, especially in a question relating to goods, made it necessary for Arnold to take some self-protective action, which he did in his letter to General Schuyler. Meanwhile, a very ugly rumor ran through the American army that General Benedict Arnold had tried to pull a scurvy trick of graft, but had been held up by the strict conduct of Colonel Hazen. Moreover, it was rumored, and the fact was admitted by Arnold in his letter, that in the transfer the goods were well sorted over, so that when they finally arrived, a great part of them was missing. All the principal facts were admitted by Arnold, who used them, however, to throw blame on Colonel Hazen. He even went so far as to prefer charges against Colonel Hazen, forcing the matter into a court-martial. That's some chutzpah there. The court was called and refused to hear the witnesses chosen by General Arnold in his behalf, on the ground that the witnesses were not entitled to credibility. Whereupon, General Arnold flouted the court, who ordered him arrested. General Gates, to preserve the useful services of Arnold to the United States Army, dissolved the court-martial, to that extent condoning the conduct of Arnold. Before the court-martial dissolved, however, it informally acquitted Colonel Hazen with honor. Here, then, almost immediately, as it would seem, upon his new connection with David Salisbury Franks. Benedict Arnold is involved in a bad tangle concerning property, which had come into his possession irregularly and which disappeared soon after. His attempt to throw the blame on an officer whose disobedience was the factor that disclosed the true state of affairs failed. It was his bold scheme to forestall an exposure which must inevitably have come. While it is true that on this Montreal case no verdict stands recorded against Benedict Arnold for the theft of goods, it is also true that the American army became suspicious of him from that day. Had Benedict Arnold been innocent then, and had he kept his hands clean thereafter, the Montreal episode would have been forgotten. But as a matter of fact, such affairs came with increasing frequency thereafter, all of them, strangely enough, involving also the Jew whom he had associated with himself at the time of that first exposure. The story of this Jew's relations with Benedict Arnold all through the period ending with the Great Treason may now be taken up with greater consecutiveness, for now their formerly separate courses run together. In another article, this relationship and all that it meant will be illustrated from the government records.
Very good.
Thank you.
This is what we have to look forward to. And there's two, the next two chapters are about Benedict Arnold, and they go into all this detail. Well, we did finish this in plenty of good time because we kept quiet and didn't comment much. This was 8th October 1921. So, I'll let you, I can come up with a few things to chat about here, but I'll give you first chance, Hattie.
Well, they certainly weren't very alert, about Ben. I guess they didn't have that the whole psychology worked out, 250 years ago about, what makes a likely traitor. Somebody must have thought of it, though.
What do you mean? Like a spendthrift?
Spendthrift. A guy that's very self-indulgent. He's obviously not got the communal spirit,
Well, they didn't have anything against Jews, so they didn't see that Jews would be working on that. So why would you, who would make the guy a traitor? I suppose you could say, well, since he wanted money, he could have been selling out to the British. But I don't think it was the British that were where they were getting their money. Although the British would have been looking the other way, right? I mean, how are you meaning that exactly?
I didn't quite catch the question.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that you said that they didn't have it figured out what makes a traitor. But how would you, you have to be suspicious. Not just of somebody who's a spendthrift, but you have to be suspicious that there's people who are really involved in it. In this case, in almost every case that we find, the Jews are behind it. And this is what is not acknowledged today and wasn't then either.
Well, I think the motive for the revolution was largely economic. And what they, England was already plutocratic anyway,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I would be talking about something I haven't researched in great depth, but Benedict Arnold was just exhibiting that same materialist, self-seeking ethos, which has become very strong today, to the point that nobody. There's a guy, William S. Lind. He wrote a book called The Next Conservatism. He used to work for a couple of senators, actually. He worked for Gary Hart and another one. But anyway, he's a conservative, and he said back in, I think he said the 80s, about half the people in the Congress, half the representatives and senators in the Congress, were actually interested in governing the country. They actually had some ideals other than just fattening their own wallet. He said today it's about 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've really got a whole House of Representatives and Senate that's 90% of the Benedict Arnold type today. That's what we've got.
Yeah, but Benedict Arnold, he also, I think, could have got his nose bent out of shape a little bit by any little thing. You know, and then if he wasn't doing well enough, or if he had had all these great, I guess he had a very good record. He had exhibited a lot of bravery. He had caused a lot of wins for the Revolutionary Army, supposedly. I don't know how many, because I don't know how much time went by, but, you know, some. And then he might have thought he didn't get enough from it, or he was, you know, wasting his time. This kind of, and that goes again back to that selfish attitude, like, well, what's in it for me? You know, there's not enough in this for me. I should be benefiting. Go ahead.
That's the prevalent ethos in the United States. What's in it for me? We even have this doctrine that we take very seriously today, that was first stated by Mandeville, Bernard de Mandeville. Private vice makes public virtue. In other words, if everybody just seeks his own gain, it'll work out to be for the good of everybody. So we actually don't even believe that self-seeking like that needs to be curbed. We don't recognize that need. But, the fact is, there is a contradiction between unlimited pursuit of individual gain and the general good. This superstition that it all corrects itself was brought back in the late 70s by people like Milton Friedman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Supposed to all work out like an invisible hand correcting everything. Doesn't
well,
work
a lot,
that way.
A lot of times these people like Benedict Arnold they have a personality that wins people over. I think it said that in here. You know, that he had winning ways and so on. And there's so many, I'm going to bring in something totally different here, but there's so many alcoholics who have very likable personalities and really get people to like them, and they really are nice people. They really are good. But they have this weakness of not being able to resist whatever their temptation is pulling them down. And this is the same with somebody like Benedict Arnold and so many of these people. And they, you notice that one thing I noticed was that they mentioned in here that Washington, General Washington, was instigating strong discipline, and he had people whipped and so on, soldiers who had
looted
and stolen and so on. And that made me think of Hitler and just his National Socialist army, the Wehrmacht and so on under the National Socialists, that they were very, and the SS especially instituted very strict discipline.
Yeah, you go up against the wall with the SS and you steal anything.
Yeah, and I mean, they didn't tolerate anything. And see, this was, they learned from all this, possibly, that you just couldn't tolerate it because there was too much at stake. And, but then Washington was trying to be nice to Benedict Arnold. I think it's in the next chapter, though, where he gave him the opportunity to lead the next charge in a battle, and then Benedict Arnold showed that he was not happy with that, that what he really wanted to do was go back and run West Point or something, and that's when Washington realized that there was something wrong with this guy.
But
I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see, but it's real easy to feel that, well, you got to give somebody another chance, or I have a problem with that, and I suppose that might be partly a female thing, but it's also a lot of men. You know, you don't want to be too harsh, and I often think when I read about SS men who were shot and who were, you know, by their own troops and so on, who were heart disciplined, thrown in prison and so on, I think, oh, that's so harsh, you know. They shouldn't treat him that badly. So, you know, I have a hard time thinking that you should... that you should do that. And that's where these people get, I suppose, that's how these people get away with things, because you feel sorry for them. You feel something for them. This, well, he didn't really mean it, you know, and well, give him another chance. And but what about the Jewish angle? I mean, right here, you know, the whole lesson here is that what was behind all this were these Jews. Now, this we're going to find out maybe that this David Soulsbury Franks targeted him and Arnold and made friends with him and set up this business partnership.
Yeah, well, you say targeted him. There, but you know what? The problem is really... The problem really isn't Satan, it's the sinner that yields to Satan, right? That's where the real problem is.
Yeah, but then you get to that thing where Tanstoffel doesn't like it, where we end up saying it's not the Jews' fault, it's the white people's fault.
Well, that's not the same thing as saying it's not the Jews' fault, but you know, you can't make the Jews not be Jews.
Yeah.
The fundamental problem with Benedict Arnold was Benedict Arnold. The Jews were his collaborators in treason, yeah.
Yes, some but did. You know what? But this whole society had allowed, and the whole army society, the whole army had allowed these Jews to be seen as highly respectable people,
yes,
working for the army and so on. So that's that has to play a part.
That's
why would you then say, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with these Jews?
Yeah, that's because of what it says there about the fact that they could be respected if they had wealth. That's a weakness of any society that values wealth above everything else. Not every society is like that.
But what kind of primitive societies? Because it's pretty hard, you know, wealth equals power. It's pretty hard not to be impressed by power and wealth unless you kind of make yourself into a
Wealth is only one kind of power. It depends, and whether wealth is the ultimate form of power depends on various other conditions, like whether how much chaos there is in the particular situation. If there's a lot of instability, then having wealth by itself isn't worth much because somebody will take it from you. In that case, whoever is the best general is going to have the highest status.
Yeah, well, let me just say this, that, I lost what I was going to say. We've got 60 seconds. But if non-Jewish people don't do the things for wealth in the same way that Jews do, so we come back all the time to our biggest problem is Jews, and to say, well, you can't stop them from being Jews. Well, you can get them out of your society.
Are definitely a problem, but there's a more fundamental problem, which is the way a lot of our own people think.
Well, I don't know. I think it's easier to get rid of the Jews than to change everything about the way our people think.
But you won't solve the problem until you change that thinking.
Well, good luck with a change in thinking in that way so that people don't have any, you know, love for wealth and pomp and power. Okay, well, we talked our way through that time, and we're ready to hear our music and say goodbye for tonight, and do come back next week for the next great installment.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.